All right, everybody, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator. We have a guest today. His name is Dr. Frederick Whitehurst. He's the founder and director of the Forensics Justice Project at the National Whistleblower Center in Atlanta. He worked for the FBI for 16 years, working on everything from bank robberies to heroin smuggling, and eventually becoming the supervisor of the FBI Crime Lab, where he worked for 12 years. In 1997, he went public about serious problems in the Crime Lab's work in major cases, including the first bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, the Waco case, and the Oklahoma City bombing. He testified last May 19th at the trial on state charges of Terry Nichols, who is already convicted on federal charges. Welcome to the show, Dr. Whitehurst.
Thank you, sir.
It's an honor to have you here. May I ask, what was the substance of your testimony to the court last month?
Well, I think it's a matter of public record, so I can talk about it. Essentially, they wanted to understand the meaning of the data, that the scientific data concerning explosive residue analysis in the case. And there was also some concerns about the truth of testimony of another FBI agent at the crime lab.
Yes, in fact, I read in the Associated Press that you accused another agent, a former associate of yours in the crime lab, of actual perjury on the stand. Is that correct?
Well, the things that he said in the McVeigh trial and the Nichols trial were not correct. Sometimes we make mistakes under oath, but there were some statements that he made he knew very well were not the truth. And that was what counsel was interested in and the court was interested in. So, yeah, I did say that.
And what was the substance of his testimony that you found was not just inaccurate, but obviously purposely inaccurate?
Well, I think the thing that bothered me was there are concerns in any laboratory that does trace analysis, looking for small amounts of material that you can't even see with your eye. There's concerns about contamination. Where could the material have come from? Did it come from evidence at the crime scene, or was it in the lab and possibly transferred from the lab to evidence itself, and therefore it doesn't mean anything? The evidence controls situation at the FBI crime lab and the contamination controls there were not very good at all. And, the lab that I worked in was a thoroughfare through it, and about anybody could go through there that worked at the FBI lab and was on special tours.
I thought that forensic evidence was always very carefully kept in separate bags and that kind of thing, no?
Well, to the outside layperson, that might appear to be the truth, but in reality, they're human beings doing those jobs, and the ideal breaks down at times. And in the FBI crime lab, because there really is no outside independent audit, there's no oversight at all. The controls break down, and nobody does anything about it, and then they pretty much just then go away. And so your idea that evidence is very well controlled is it doesn't really measure up when you look at the reality of the situation.
And in this case, we're talking about ammonium nitrate crystals that are tied to Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh and to the bombing, right?
Well, what we're talking about is an individual who found those crystals, and at the time he found them, I thought it was a very brilliant find. He worked very hard. He's a very good man. I worked side by side with him. He'd been my student, and I was very pleased and amazed that he found the crystals. As time went on and I realized that he had not told the truth while under oath, I began to wonder if it was too amazing a situation. In other words, what happened is once I read his testimony and saw what he was saying was wrong, it's just not right, and he knew it wasn't right, then it cast doubt on anything else he did have to say there. And so where did those crystals come from? Now, I can't imagine them having come from contamination. I couldn't imagine before that anybody put them on that piece of material on which they were found. But there were some questions about them that a scientist would ask. It was unreasonable that they'd be there. It was kind of fortuitous that he found them, or was it fortuitous? What I'm saying, the short of it is, because he did not tell the truth under oath, that cast reasonable doubt in my mind as to where those crystals actually came from.
Is this the only evidence, the assertions by this agent, is this the only evidence of an ammonium nitrate bomb in Oklahoma City, or are there other things that point to that same conclusion?
Well, one thing you've got is blast damage. But there are so many different types of explosives that it could have caused the same blast damage that you have to narrow down to what kind of explosive was it. Another thing that points towards the use, but in a sort of a circuitous way, if you will, in an inappropriate way, is, well, the people we think are guilty can be associated with ammonium nitrate. Well, we're not supposed to go about it that way. You know, finally, the chemist has to tell you what the explosive was, if that's possible. The trace analyst has to tell you. An explosives engineer is not going to be able to tell you that because there are so many, there are tens of thousands of types of explosives out there. And there's so many explosives that could have caused the same damage. So, it was a very important piece of information. And I wasn't there at that trial to say that ammonium nitrate wasn't found on that piece of that item. I was there to say to the trier of fact, there is reason to doubt the credibility of this information. You know, simply, this man did not tell the truth under oath before.
You mentioned that what you call in your writings working backwards. That
yes.
Is, well, we're pretty sure that this guy and this guy did it, and it seems like we found a receipt for some fertilizer at this guy's house, so it must have been a fertilizer bomb that went off in front of the building. Is that accurate?
Sure, that's you've got it right there. Go find the person you want to prove to be guilty and have, you say, well, this guy's guilty, therefore the data that we've got is consistent with the fact that he's guilty. And it's just a very dangerous way to go about things, and it's not science at all.
I'm really confused as to how he was convicted. I'm imagining myself on that jury and hearing you dispute that they have any real science to back up their very basic, the most basic assertion about the case, which is that it was a fertilizer bomb parked in a Ryder truck outside. And if they don't have that, then the whole rest of the case should entirely be in doubt. Am I wrong?
You know, just because one person fails doesn't make, that jury had a lot of evidence to look at. They listened. Nobody was sleeping when I testified. And just because one individual, there's information that one individual, well, one part of the investigation might have gone wrong, but that doesn't mean that all the rest of the evidence can be thrown out. You know, a lot of people want to look at criminal investigation in that way. If there's one problem with it, then you throw it out, and that's not. There is an error rate with any human enterprise. And just because you failed in one aspect doesn't make the guy innocent or guilty. We ultimately, because it's the system we've chosen, we have to choose to believe our jurors, or I do anyhow. I believe in the American justice system. And they looked at a whole bunch of evidence. It wasn't just the evidence about whether there was ammonium nitrate crystals present or not.
Well, I understand what you're saying there, but we're talking about, a threshold of beyond a reasonable doubt, and it brings to my mind something like the O.J. Simpson case, where it seems to me pretty obvious that he did it, and I would tell you that I believe that he did it. However, if I'd been on the jury, it would have been up to the state to prove that he did it, and I'm not so sure that the state did their job of proving it, and I guess I'm looking at the Nichols thing the same way. Seems like he's guilty. But if the FBI's case is based, the very basic assertion is based on a fertilizer truck bomb parked outside, and they don't have any real science to prove that, that to me would mean, I hate to turn it around that the state's on trial, but that they don't earn a reasonable doubt to me.
Well, suppose ammonium nitrate crystals have never been found. A bomb certainly went off, didn't it?
Well, yeah, it seems that way.
A bomb certainly went off, and there was a lot of other evidence. I would imagine I didn't really follow the trial that closely. There was a lot of other evidence that was consistent with, if not proof of, but all the pieces put together convinced a jury of guilt. I think ultimately, you and I can sit here and say we do the armchair director type of thing. However, there were, what, 12 jurors there and two alternates that sat there and listened to all of it. They listened to all of it. And we didn't. You and I didn't. And so it's sort of like, you know, in the O.J. Simpson trial, I was Johnny Cochran's mystery witness. And Judge Ito wouldn't let me on board. I mean, he wouldn't let me testify. And I have to defer to his expertise as a judge. You know, folks back then said, well, you know, wasn't that a terrible thing? Well, no. If I'm testifying about science, about chemistry, I don't expect Judge Ito to work his way into my expertise. He has to listen to me and weigh what I've got, you know. And so here, really, I think, you know, I don't mean to insult you, but I think that you're simplifying this thing. There was a lot of evidence that these people had to look at. And unless you and I listened to it and spent those weeks and weeks and weeks there with the jury, then I'm not sure, you know, you can have that personal opinion like you do about O.J. Simpson, but I'm not sure that that I would follow you there. Frankly, I don't have all the data. I was a chemist involved, and, you know, I was in the lab then, and that's my piece of it. But there's other pieces and parts. Whether there's any doubt to them or not, I don't know that.
Oh, I understand. Well, and, you know, I think maybe we should explain to people your background a little bit. If they're not familiar with the name Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, you came out publicly in 1997 about serious problems in the crime lab and other major cases as well as the Oklahoma City bombing, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And what was it that made you come out public at that time?
Actually, I'd had issues with the FBI crime lab the day I walked in. The area in which I was working was a pigsty from the trace analysis point of view. You might have been willing to eat eggs off the floor because it would have appeared to be that clean, but when you're looking for materials that you can't even see, that you have to have highly sophisticated instruments to find, and there's dust bunnies in the corner, and there's a public thoroughfare going through where, you know, people in the FBI building could go through and tours and whatever. And there's various and sundry things going on, like folks rewriting your reports without your knowledge or authorization or whatever.
And that happened to you?
Yeah, those things are troubling. It's troubling to me that I have a doctorate in chemistry and a fellow with a degree in political science who has no scientific training or expertise at all can, for 5 years, rewrite my reports without my knowledge or authorization.
Did you not find out about this until the end of the 5 years? Or you found out halfway through?
It was about 1993 that came out. In that particular situation, a technician of mine had carried some stuff over to the fellow, and the guy said, I don't care what he wrote, I'm going to fix it anyhow. Well, that was astonishing, so I just went to all my reports I'd written for him and found out he'd altered them all. And, you know, those were not the only issues. There were people testifying beyond their areas of expertise. The lab was not an accredited lab. It's never been audited in. If the FBI has anything to do with it, then there will be an independent audit of the lab, but I'm afraid that's going to change.
Well, that's quite surprising. I hear you say it's not even audited. I thought that the FBI, I mean, again, this is, I'm sure, just the public relations on TV, but the FBI is always referred to as the hired standard of scientific evidence, and if they say so, then it must be true.
Well, you know, that's one thing about science. It doesn't satisfy itself with dictators. And science in secrecy ceases to exist, and that's what's going on there. If you really delve into the science, in many areas there isn't any. It's simply, I said it, therefore it's true. And we've found, you know, we are impatient as an American people with that kind of authority. We struck out from another nation and became an independent nation because we wouldn't be dictated to. And frankly, these inappropriate activities that we see there at the FBI and the crime lab, we shouldn't be appropriating funds for, and we believe that, and we go along with that. If you follow the history of the lab since about 1995, you see they've had one problem after another. They've just convicted a woman in the DNA group for putting out false reports for, what, almost 2 years, 2.5 years. They had a bullet lead examiner convicted last year in Kentucky of telling a lie in a trial or in a hearing. you know, they're not going to, you know, they've just had this fingerprint business with Mr. Maisio. They're being discovered, and we just won't tolerate it. I'm certainly sure you won't, and I won't. And when we get in, our representatives get ready to appropriate funds, they'll be looking for places where they know they're getting the right answer. We don't know what answer we're getting from the FBI. We don't know if it's the right answer or not because they refuse to be audited. But every forensic lab in the United States is following suit. You know, to carry this a little further, clinical laboratories are audited. Any testing laboratory in the United States is audited. You want to know if they're giving you the right answer. You have no idea when you walk into a court of law and the FBI is standing there in the role of scientist whether they're giving you the right answer, because nobody's ever determined that. They'll tell you it's the right answer, but...
It sounds like a pretty scary thing to be on trial in federal court.
Or they don't just go in federal court. About 80% of the cases are state court also.
Right.
You know, as we see innocent people being free based upon DNA, and we project that further to people being free as a result of revelations from that IG report of the FBI lab, we begin to realize that these aren't simply human beings. They can fail too. And their biggest failing is they refuse to determine what their failure rate is. That's really bottom line what it is.
And I'm sorry that I diverted you from your originally telling the little narrative there about why it was that you decided to come out publicly after years of frustration with what had been going on in the crime lab there.
Well, actually, I reported up my chain of command for 8 years, and I wasn't public. ABC News outed me. I started when I found out that neither my unit chief nor my section chief or assistant section chief nor the director of the lab nor the director of the FBI nor, at that time, the Senate Judiciary Committee would do anything about it. I went to the Inspector General, and I wrote somewhere around 237 letters to the Inspector General over a period of about 5 years. Why would you decide to do that? Well, the decision was taken out of my hands when I raised my hand at in Quantico in 1982 and took an oath of office to uphold the Constitution and enforce the laws. I didn't take that oath and say, unless I see somebody with a badge doing something wrong, I said, uphold the Constitution, enforce the law.
Well, what a refreshing take to hear from a government official.
Well, you know what's strange, though? 30 people strongly backed me up. FBI managers backed me up. FBI managers testified before Congress and the Senate Judiciary Committee, before the Congressional Oversight. You know, it seems to be sort of a slam. A lot of people see this as a slam on the FBI. They're very, very good people there. I know when we were in 1993, when we were there for the investigation of the World Trade Center bombing, I was with a crew of about 15 people, and when after 10 days of 22 hours a day, we were just dogged tired. We had to stand down. People were fighting with me. I was running the chemical analysis crew. They were fighting with me. They were arguing with me. No, we got to keep going. Everybody was just falling over exhausted. No, they're good people. There's a management cadre that's terrified of exposure, and good people can only go so far against managers. But since I came out, I know the law firm that represented me has had over 200 FBI employees contact them trying to get representation because the FBI hires very good people, certainly. They don't go out and find bad guys. And those people have to make a choice between their country or their family security. And a lot of them make a choice for the country. A lot of them. And so this, it isn't a slam against the FBI. It's just a statement. FBI managers and politicians refuse to allow us to know whether the FBI is doing the job right or not. Okay, well, it's going to happen another way.
It does sort of sound like a slam against the supervisors. And this is something that I've seen in far different cases other than just what you describe, and that the lowest level special agent of the FBI is really out there busting his hump trying to get things done, and his bosses are always telling him to go away. Is this
well, that happens.
Story you hear all the time?
Yes, that happens. You know, the reason we make a big thing of it may be because it's an aberration. When I was in the Bureau, supervisors were an evil that we had to put up with, and people at the FBI headquarters referred to as view humps were somebody that you ignored if you could get away with it. They're back there. The place was top-heavy till Louis Freeh came in. And, you know, just people wanting to have a high-paying desk job back at headquarters. But I think when you've rewarded people and they can look forward to a six-figure retirement paycheck for the rest of their life, you make it very difficult for them to choose their country over themselves. When they know that if they expose something as senior managers, they won't see that pension. And that pension means, essentially, they're, as long as there's a United States of America, they've got security, which a lot of people just don't have in this country. Then how will they expose? If we were to follow them into pension and say, if you knew about it and you didn't do anything about it, we're going to take your pension away, just like they did to those soldiers over there in Iraq recently. You saw this going on in the prisons, you didn't do anything about it. Son, you had to do something about it. Therefore, we're coming after you. Well, if FBI managers knew, it will follow them to the grave. If a pension can follow them to the grave, then their responsibilities can follow them to the grave. And by golly, a lot of them would step up. But we don't encourage that as a nation.
Right. Well, but aren't there whistleblower protections where they can't fire you? I guess.
No.
I like that laugh.
That's an absolute myth. I had to sue the President of the United States, Bill Clinton, in order to get the Whistleblower Protection Act to even get implemented at the FBI and Department of Justice. The FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the U.S. Department of Justice refused to obey federal law. 1989 Whistleblower Protection Act, they refused. They were in criminal contempt of the United States Congress and the United States people for, 79 years there. When they finally implemented the Whistleblower Protection Act, I would have been worse off had the act been implemented. There is no protection. When you decide to do something like what I decided to do, what others decided to do, you have decided that your nation and the security of your neighbors is more important than your family and the security of your family. You have just made that decision, and you're going down. For some reason, the American society will not protect, refuses to protect people that come forward and say, no, enough. If we just do as a nation, we may be maybe we're a nation of cowards, or we just got too busy doing something else. But there is absolutely no protection at all. You can, as I told so many of them, they call me, they say, what should I do? It's the first thing you're going to do is hire an attorney. Second thing you're going to do is realize you may win in the court, but you're going to lose in the cocktail lounge. People in the security, national security arena, that, you know, they'll say, I've seen something going on. I say, fine. You may win. However, you're going to be blackballed by these people, and nothing's going to happen to them. You know, nothing's going to happen to them.
How did they retaliate against you when you went public?
Let me see. I went to the shrink because I must be crazy. They sent me to the shrink, and that's what they do. They call it a fitness for duty evaluation, which is just vulgar. I would rather be a prisoner an Iraqi prisoner in Iraq than go through what the FBI is labeling you as you're a nutcase. But let me see. I was under three criminal investigations, three criminal inquiries. They got as petty as taking me away from the office by the window. I mean, you know, with a window, all of that kind of stuff. Just taking me off of any kind of work projects that were. You know, I mean, I finally ended up running the FBI's robotics program, which didn't even exist, and it essentially took me offline.
What exactly was your lawsuit? I know you won over $1 million from the federal government, right?
Yeah, well, what I won, sir, was my paycheck. You and everyone like you in this country made a contract with me that I would be on board until I retired, and you pay me if I did my job right. I did my job right. The FBI decided that as a lack of comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, between me and my colleagues, I needed to leave. I didn't want to go. But if you made a contract with me, then you're going to pay me till my contract's up, the way I signed the contract. And that's what I got. I got my paycheck and my retirement. And essentially, that's the way I configured it, and that's the way I'm living now. We sued Clinton to get a writ of mandamus to force him to obey federal law. Of course, a lot of people were trying to sue Bill Clinton for the same reason. Okay, in other words, he was supposed to implement or order the implementation of the Whistleblower Protection Act. We sued under Freedom of Information Act. We sued under Privacy Act. We sued under First Amendment, violations and all that kind of whatever. And so, finally, the lawsuit was settled with the FBI through mediation, and then also with the U.S. Department of Justice through mediation. Clinton just folded. I mean, he didn't want a writ of mandamus issued against him. He would have been one of the only presidents that had that distinction, and so he just folded.
Well, I've been looking over this Inspector General's report, mm-hmm. and I notice he tends to be pretty dismissive of your claims while at the same time validating them. Is that just me?
You know, I think what Mike Bromwich did, he was the Inspector General, was absolutely amazing. Here's the basis we had to work under. I was required under Executive Order 12674 to report fraud, waste, abuse, and corruption to the appropriate authority. I was required under FBI rules and regulations to report any indication of misconduct. Just because there's an indication of misconduct does not mean there's misconduct. If you look at the batting average for any police organization, they might come up with 5 out of 100 suspects that lead to some sort of fruition. If you're talking about a secret society like the FBI, which has been secret since its inception, okay, and you're saying there's this issue and this issue and this issue, the fact that so many of those issues were exposed is absolutely remarkable, and it took a lot of courage on Mr. Bromwich's part to do that. It just did. He very well could have been put in the same position I was put in to, stuck in a back corner, if you will, relieved, and had somebody come in there who was doing a political hatchet job. So, if you really read the executive section of that, the executive summary of that report, it pretty much nails out. There's about 9 or 10 cents of the FBI lab there, and they're pretty phenomenal. Just because something appeared to be a violation or whatever, I was required to report it. I did it. It didn't mean that there was a violation. I could say this guy appears to have committed perjury under oath. Let's look at it. But I couldn't pick and choose. I don't know what other people are doing. They're picking and choosing, but I couldn't pick and choose, and I didn't choose to. I'm telling you, as a field investigator for 4 years, man, we ran after every wisp of smoke out there. We were required to run after every wisp of smoke, and if the raw data the FBI's got ever hit the light of day, nobody could live with his neighbor, any neighbor, All I was doing was reporting indications of misconduct. Now, some of those indications of misconduct, which they failed to look at, are now coming to light of day, too. It just takes more than Mike Bromwich, more effort than Mike Bromwich was allowed to put into it.
So his dismissal of your claims, he's sort of exaggerating what you're claiming in the first place to then say, see, Frederick Whitehurst isn't right about this, when you were basically saying, well, look, I'm just saying, Is that a correct characterization, you think?
I there were some places there where the IG's office chose to interpret some things I was saying and not in what was in my letters. I said, okay, well, I, people are trying to save themselves. It's a freight train. As one of my colleagues told me, who still works at the FBI crime lab, he said, Fred, the veil of culpability has gone too far. This will never stop. Now, this is a mess. It was a freight train. And it was coming down a track right at a rabbit that was, you know, and somebody was saying, it was just, wait a minute, we gotta stop this thing. It's bleeding to death. Essentially, I was an artery of information headed out to the FBI. You know, what takes me 5 to 6 years now to get under Freedom of Information Act took me a 5-minute walk up to the FBI files. And when I found out people were altering my reports, I spent time in the files, you know, in the heart of the FBI. And, you know, there were some people that told me, and my goodness, a lot of stuff never came out, that said the American people will just finally close up to this. Fred, it's too frightening. You need to pick your battles. Well, okay. That wasn't in the manual, you know. It said, report any indication of misconduct, and that's what I did.
Well, and they do, they really do have an interesting point there, don't they? That if what you say is, if it's really as bad as it is in the FBI crime lab, as you're saying it is in the FBI crime lab, then, you know, maybe they really do have a point that the politicians and the Congress and the executive branch and that the American people ourselves, that we don't want to hear it, that it's that bad. Is that,
well, you know, if you wanted to hear it, if the American people wanted to hear it, they would ask for an audit of forensic labs. And they will eventually, because people like Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld and the Innocence Projects are showing that our justice system makes some horrible mistakes. I mean, the state of Illinois has woken up, you know. But we do make horrible mistakes, and we're looking for closure. You know, we see World Trade Center bombing or Oklahoma City bombing or a murder on the street. We're looking for closure, and we're so selfish in our desire for closure that we don't want to look for truth necessarily. Now, we may profess to want to look for it, but, you know, I'm a practicing attorney myself right now. The courts are not ready to really go out there and work, and maybe because there's just no time to work on cases and really, through discovery, find out what really has been going on. If we opened our criminal justice system to the same sort of discovery that the civil justice system is, oh, my goodness gracious, we wouldn't have a prison overcrowding situation. But I think if there's a comparison you can make, and it's the clinical laboratories. In the 60s and 70s, there was a growing awareness that innocent folks were being victimized by bad science in clinical laboratories. A guy would go in with an ulcer and come out with cancer, you know what I'm saying, or a diagnosis, you know what I mean?
Right.
Things are being misdiagnosed. So what you've got is you've got a lobby out there that says we need these laboratories cleaned up. And what happened was the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Act of 1991 was passed. And if you're in a clinical laboratory doing the exact same sample with the exact same analytical equipment, with the exact same level of expertise of people, there is an audit trail that anybody can come and look at. And it's a stack of paper for any one case. Go into the forensic lab, you can't tell whether the job's being done right or not. Now, there are people in those labs with a lot of bravado, backed up by, for instance, in the FBI, it's a $4 billion a year industry. Try yourself, sir, or one of your listeners, to fight that. You know, what are you going to do? That guy's got the gun. That guy's got the assistant U.S. attorney who's not going to let you look at the evidence. Who's going to hide it from you? Try doing something about that. Well, how do you? You can't. And I think basically the reason we don't have auditing of crime labs is because we perceive the victims as bad guys. You know, clinical laboratory victims are good guys. But crime lab victims are, they probably did something anyhow. It's that kind of attitude. In other words, we do accept a little of this, guilty until proven innocent. In this society.
Well, and it ought to be said, I think, that when the innocent are convicted, then that means the real perpetrator is still free running around out there somewhere.
Yes, that's right.
And shouldn't that be like on the top of our list of things to worry about when the innocent go to prison?
I think, yes, and I agree with you. I think all of us got to go to work and we've got mortgages, and we've got put kids through college, and we've got old age to worry about, and oh my gosh, now I have to worry about the justice system. There's an easy solution to this crime lab thing. It didn't take a Fred Whiters. It will. There's going to be a few more of them come out. If you look across the nation, crime labs are failing horribly across the nation. But you know, there's some big public scandals that we see on the state and federal level in crime land. And finally, people are going to say it's going to be very inexpensive for us to audit these labs. Very inexpensive. It's going to cost us a lot less of our taxpayers' dollars than when these people sue us who have been put in jail based upon the lies of people in crime labs. Not all people, but you can have, say, 10 guys in a crime lab and one of them's a liar. And that one liar, working over a period of 20 years, can put down 400 or 500 people. You know, and if you look at that, you got to pay each one of them $1 million because he spent time in prison. Do you know what I'm saying? In civil litigation.
Sure. In fact, I read something that you wrote about 3,000 cases, and the inspector general, I don't remember all the numbers, but the inspector general said, well, you know, that's a measly 4% or whatever of cases that they handle. And then you really worked some magic with those numbers and extrapolated that out as to how many innocent people that might mean are in prison.
Sure. You know, I testified for the Senate Judiciary Committee. We don't want to over-infer this data. We don't want to say that crime labs are horrible. Oh, my gosh, good people in crime labs, okay. But we don't want to under-infer it either. Every time an innocent man is released from death row or from long prison, we see it in the national news every time. And if we truly believe that every one of us is important, which we pretty much have to, or we have to decide which one of us isn't important, okay, if we truly believe that, then 3,000 cases? You know, there was a trick they played there, too. Those cases, they found the problems with the cases, and then they told the prosecutors. They didn't tell the defendants, they told the prosecutors. The prosecutors got to decide whether they wanted to pull this stuff out of the muck or not. Well, if a guy's been in jail for 20 years, that prosecutor says, I don't have any evidence anymore. I don't have any witnesses. Half these people are dead, gone. We couldn't find them. We've got no case. Well, are the prosecutors all going to decide to do something? No. No, you know, quite a number of them are going to say, I don't need this mess. The FBI caused it. And so people will go notify. The Forensic Justice Project will, at least until I'm dead, try to find all those people and send them all letters. And, you know, we've got reams and reams of information here, and just give it to them free.
So you guys at the Forensic Justice Project, you basically sue through the Freedom of Information Act for those records that are given to the prosecutors, and then you notify the defendants, is that it?
We're in the process. We are in the process of doing that. There are other ways of finding these people, but, you know, I'm contacted here where somebody will say, are there other guys? And, you know, all of this, by the way, is it's a non-profit, no money involved. We're not interested. You know, folks will say, can we make a donation? Or some of my people would give me grief for saying this, but the donation is time. Find a case out there. Pull the evidence in, pull the, pull the transcripts in, pull the data in. That's a donation. So it's essentially, you know, a grassroots type of thing. Just like electing a president. We don't need, we don't even need a secretary. We just all do our own work. But the idea is to get this information, to compile it, put it in one place, and then just let anybody have it that wants it. Sir, if you want it, I give it to you. We're trying to figure out how to do the website, but it's so voluminous. You know, for one thing, I've got 2,500 FBI files that I got under Freedom of Information Act. It was the largest FOIA request of its kind in the FBI's history. It's, they're laboratory files. What I was trying to do with that is to find the people that got hurt, study the issues, and see if it made a difference. And then let those people know. Not tell a prosecutor who's got too much work already. Just tell the defendants if they wish to revisit the issues, fine. If they don't, go on with life.
This is the Weekend Interview Show, and I'm interviewing Dr. Frederick Whitehurst. He's the former supervisor of the FBI Crime Lab. Sir, you narrated a video called Waco, A New Revelation, that leveled some pretty serious charges about the government's actions there. And you said in the introduction that you don't believe that the American people have ever been told the full truth about the disaster at Waco, Texas in 1993. Do you still feel that way?
Yes.
And what
I don't think they ever will be.
What do you think of the full truth that we don't know?
Well, I don't know the full truth either, sir. But what that group that put that film together did was to look at specific issues and look at the input from the government about those specific issues. You know, for instance, the pyrotechnic rounds. Who said what when they said it? Well, we went out and redid an analysis of, we did a forensic exam and a crime scene back at Mount Carmel. We found out there was potassium perchlorate, which is an oxidizer in a pyrotechnic round, and all of a sudden, oh my goodness, yes, we did fire pyrotechnic rounds. If you're gonna do that kind of thing, you know, if you're gonna say the American people really don't need to know, they're foolish, they're immature, they're childish, they're stupid, we need to control them, so we're not going to give them all the information, and you get caught at it, then you're seen as somebody that's manipulating the trier of fact, not educating the trier of fact. The ideal role of the FBI is an educator. Go out there and find the information and act as the eyes and ears of the trier of fact. But in reality, we too often have the FBI slipping into a manipulation. Well, there were no pyrotechnic rounds fired, they said. Okay, well, you know, a lot of the issues, the FLIR issue, was the same sort of thing.
Why don't you talk about that for a little bit?
Well, it was a step-by-step process in which, okay, well, let's see the evidence. Let's have experts talk about it. Let's see whether there were rounds being fired from the ground. Let's show that evidence. And here is a point of view. It's an alternative point of view. It's the same. I found when I was working at the FBI that there was a lot of blinders on. Focus on one possibility. And if you introduced any alternative explanations for the data, you could be a member of the team. In the World Trade Center bombing trial, for instance, the 1993, I had one of my reports sent back to me with yellow magic marker over all the alternative explanations for the data, and my boss telling me, I don't agree with it, Fred, but whoever they were cowards. They would never expose themselves. They don't want it in your report. And I remember specifically looking out the window to E Street on a rainy day saying, well, they can blankety-blank fire me then. I'm not going to lie in this report, nor am I going to lie in the court. Oh, well, so they fired me. Okay.
Well, you did testify in the World Trade Center bombing case, the 1993, the first bombing.
No, I didn't. I didn't. They stopped me.
I read something, in fact, I think this morning or yesterday, about accusations of perjury in that case. I'm not sure if you
know what
they
did. I know. There was two sets of trials. The first one was in the bombing. And then the second was you remember the Sheikh Rahman or Rahman or whatever,
yeah.
I don't know.
Abdel
the blind Egyptian
Rahman,
cleric, yes. I was called to a hearing there. And in fact, it was a trial. It was the 15th or 14th of August of 95, just for the O.J., while the O.J. trial was going on. But I was called there, and counsel had got wind of the fact that I was writing letters to the Inspector General, and she got some of them because the stuff was exculpatory material. It was the kind of stuff that, you know, would lead someone to believe maybe all isn't right. And I just, you know, I'm going to tell you what I think is true. I think that as an American, and I am an American, I have that right. And you're going to have to shoot me to stop me from saying what I believe to be true. But you know, Phil, I may not be right. What I believe to be true may not be the truth. But if you pull me up before a trier of fact, I'm going to tell you what I think is true. I'm not going to be pushed around by FBI managers or presidents or attorneys general or whatever. You know, so you can't keep your job too often in the United States government by saying what you think is true. You know, that's kind of dangerous, as we're finding out with a man I voted for but won't vote for again in good conscience in this Iraqi thing. In that World Trade Center situation, yes, I did testify in the second trial. So it was called World Trade Center 2.
This may be outside of your area of expertise. I know you were in the FBI, but not necessarily working this part of the case in the first World Trade Center bombing or anything. However, normally I would dismiss what I read in the New York Times as, you choose left-wing or right-wing fantasy. I'm not much for that paper, especially now with all the Judith Miller stories about how there must be weapons of mass destruction under that sand dune right over there. However, I've heard a lot of very respectful things about a reporter for the New York Times named Ralph Blumenthal. And he wrote an article way back in October of 1993, I believe it was October 28th, 1993, where he said that the FBI had an undercover informant inside the World Trade Center bombing ring, and that, in fact, he was the only one of them who knew how to make the bomb, and that his supervisors had told him, well, we're going to go in this sting operation, and we're going to switch out the explosives in the bomb that you make for an inert powder, and then that way we'll catch them red-handed trying to set off the bomb, but the bomb won't go off. And then apparently this man, Salam, I believe was his name, taped his conversations with his FBI handlers where they admitted to him that indeed that was the plan, but that the FBI supervisor had called off the sting operation and the bombing was allowed to take place. Do you know about that story, sir?
I think it's public knowledge. Those of us that were the crime scene the very first day were hearing, oh my gosh, assistant special agent in charge so-and-so is really blowing it because they had an informant who could have stopped this. You know, we were hearing that on the ground. I was not part of that. I think you need to put that in perspective. I was in the FBI, and I know there are not hundreds but thousands and thousands of leads that come into the FBI all over the nation every day. I mean, we are deluged. And it's everything from somebody wanting to beat up on his estranged spouse or her estranged spouse in casting aspersions about stolen government property, whatever, all kinds of stuff. And trying to get through that data. There are only 11,000 FBI agents. There's only, 40 or 50,000 FBI employees, maybe 60. That sounds like a lot of people. But trying to get through that data, I don't think that anybody would have, you know, I know those guys, and they're, you know, a lot of them are testosterone tyrants. They're, they do a lot of it with bravado. But had they been able to avoid making that happen, they would have. I don't doubt somebody had an informant. I don't doubt somebody had an informant in all of these major issues. It's a huge organization, just trying to do an extraordinary task, which frankly is virtually impossible. And I understand the human part of it. A guy made a mistake like that, you think he's going to tell you he did? No. Okay.
Oh, no.
He is not going to tell you.
And I'm willing to accept the, like you say, the sting gone wrong. The too much, too many things to do in too little time, and somebody made a big mistake. But it seems to me, you know, it kind of bothers me that this made the front page of the New York Times once and never again, and nobody's ever talked about it ever since, apparently. That's the thing that gets me about it.
It may just be a realization that, we are so vulnerable. And people may just realize, okay, well, you know, I've heard the story for years because, you know, I was there. And I talk with folks like you and others that come in there. You wonder about that, and I've seen it written up a number of times. But it may just be a realization. We're at war. We're in the middle of a terrorist war. I really believe that. We're going to make a lot of mistakes. Abu Ghraib is one of them. And people, and maybe you consider them irresponsible, but responsible people may realize that we're going to make mistakes. That, let's show it, but then let's move on.
Well, and maybe the American people would realize that no matter how much government you have, they really can't protect you. That really the FBI's job is to prosecute the guy who did you wrong, not stop him from doing wrong to you in the first place. And that maybe if we're going to be free, that we ought to protect ourselves.
Well, you know, as I worked very closely with counterterrorism. I was in Vietnam for 3 years. You know, I've been a counterterrorist, if you will, or a counterinsurgent all of my professional life, except when I was working as a chemist. You can't stop anybody. You know, you cannot stop anybody because you get 280 million people in this country, and if one of them decides to do something, you just can't stop them. You know, and it's what the Homeland Security, and that name just gives me shudders, by the way, but it's what Homeland Security is facing.
Thank you for saying that.
It's giving them fits because, I get on and off airplanes. I'm an explosive specialist, you know, and I look what's going on there and I say, oh, come on. You know, we are so vulnerable with industrial chemicals going down railroads. The vulnerability of this country is phenomenal, and that's why people come here. It's a dream. We don't live in. It's sort of the example of when I worked at the FBI. There were places I went in the FBI that I couldn't go from the office, not in the building, but some of our sister organizations. I couldn't go from the office I was in to the restroom without an escort, and then I'd go over to academia where I'd worked a while. And it's totally open. And we're like academia next to, we are so vulnerable. We don't have to worry about getting pulled over every time we turn around and feet up and, you know, what do you call this patriarch stuff is moving us towards. But we don't have to. So if you stop and be realistic about it, though, you know, you see these incidences, and we can narrow in on them and raise Cain about them. But we need to move on to the next threat. Maybe that's too FBI of me. I don't know.
Oh, that sounds like an honest assessment to me. I'd like to ask you, sir, I surfed around a little bit in the past few days preparing for this show, and I really haven't been able to find anything that definitively explains what's going on. I read in your rebuttal to the Inspector General's report a little bit, but you're referring in that response to particular statements here and there that are somewhat out of context, and I just have to know exactly what do you have to do with the case involving the attempted assassination of George H.W. Bush in Kuwait in 1993? Or was that 94? I think 93, right?
Well, I was one of the two FBI examiners on the case, and I noted that my reports were altered in that case, and I objected to it.
Altered in what way, sir?
Well, it's pretty much in the report. You know, the things that they said they were matching devices, and one of the ways they matched the device was with explosives. And I was I ran a unique program where I was looking at, I was reverse engineering explosives, which means I was doing chemical analysis of them to find out what was in them.
Right, this isn't the same kind of working backwards that we were talking about
before. No. It's, you get an industrial object, a commercially made object, whatever, and you try and find out everything that's in it. That's called reverse engineering. And I wrote a report, and we've never seen anything like this before, and the next thing I know, my report's saying this matches stuff that, from a particular group, and I said, I'm sorry, but, I will not be part of placing people in harm's way like that. These guys that are doing this have never been in combat. They have never seen the blood and the gore of what it means to put American soldiers in combat. You better do it based upon the truth, not a lie. And I think that this nation is arising right now to, they're curious that the thing's been lied to about Iraq. Well, you know, I was furious when I found somebody, you alter my report? No. You know, there may be very, very good reason for doing what you're doing, but not based on what I said. And so that's what that mess was about. It leads me to, you know, there was a flurry there of CIA analysts who were disagreeing with the CIA about weapons of mass destruction and some of that. Do you remember that?
Yes, and George Tenet just took the fall, even though he was trying to tell the truth.
And they were put down. Okay. Well, the same sort of thing. You've got some experts up front. In between the experts and the policymakers, there's a bunch of bureaucrats, and they do what's referred to as wordsmithing. And sometimes wordsmithing becomes known as just plain doggone it lying. You know, you can change the word such as describing a solution or the solution, and it means something completely different. You know, the solution, you infer the only solution. A solution, there are other solutions, and it leads you to ask something. Do you know what I'm saying? That kind of wordsmithing becomes lies. And in my case, my reports were altered. What I had to say was altered. And
people died over it in Iraq due to our missile strike based on those lies in this case.
Well, we committed ourselves to a course of action. There is another side to it, and I'm a guy for alternative explanations. As I said, there may very well, and it wasn't just my report, it was somebody else did some work too. I wasn't the only guy involved with that stuff. And what may very well have happened is they may have had human intelligence on the ground that they didn't want to expose, so they came to the scientists and said, you know, and then just, okay, this is based on science. And I've worked in those environments where you can't expose your human sources. They're either too valuable or you've made a commitment to them. So you have an ethical obligation to do something to respond.
I must say, Dr. Whitehurst, that you have a very fair approach to debunking the lies of this government. I really appreciate it. I think it's quite refreshing to hear you being as fair to them as you're trying to be to yourself. And unfortunately, we're just straight out of time at this point. Everyone, you've been listening to an interview of Dr. Frederick Whitehurst. You can look up his Forensic Justice Project at forensicjustice.org. It's part of the National Whistleblower Center in Atlanta, Georgia. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Dr. Whitehurst.
Okay.
And I knew Billy Clinton became one of the boys when he bombed Iraq. Remember that? It was just a little news story for 2 days. Isn't that interesting? He launched 22 cruise missiles against Baghdad in retaliation for the alleged assassination attempt against George Bush, which failed. We killed 6 innocent people launching 22, I think $3 million apiece missiles on Baghdad, killing 6 innocent people. I think that's a little bit overdoing it, if you ask me. You know what we should have done? We should have embarrassed the Iraqis. You know what I mean? Here's how we could do it. We should have assassinated Bush. And said, that's how you do it, Cowhead. Don't fuck with us. And see, if Bush had been the one who had died, there would have been no loss of innocent life. We should do a car bomb derby with him. That's what we should do. Car bomb derby. Put it on after American Gladiators. We'd just watch it. Big ratings. It's good. I like Car Bomb Derby. We beat the Iraqi team again. I love that. And that way we'd all be on equal ground again. And I believe in equality. I believe there's a commonality to all humanity. We all suck. Okay, thank you.